From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning in our ongoing series on print publications in the outdoor adventure realm, the founder and publisher of Adventure Journal, Stephen Casimiro, joins my co-host Jay Burke and me. Stephen is a former editor of Powder Magazine and National Geographic Adventure. And then local author and nurse Cindy Clark will join me in the studio. She has written a new book just released called Strategic Weight Loss, 20 Practical and Effective Strategies for Lifelong Success. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
In our ongoing series about print publications not only being dead, but making a serious comeback, especially in the outdoor and mountain town space, we welcome to the show someone who's worked in the print world for decades. Stephen Casimiro is the founder and publisher of Adventure Journal, and he is a former editor of Powder and National Geographic Adventure. He was heavily featured in a New York Times piece by John Branch just a couple of days ago on pretty much the same topic. And he joins us now to talk about why we love holding a high-quality magazine in our hands and treasuring it on our coffee table. Stephen Casimiro, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Thrilled to have you, and congratulations on such a great article. You know, the thing that stuck out for me, I think it was the editor of Surfer Journal who said something about leaning in and leaning back, the difference between when we look at something digitally, we have to lean into the screen and it's flat. But when we hold a magazine in our hands, we can lean back into the sofa with our cup of coffee and relax and just enjoy. Tell us more.
Well, the roots of AJ Imprint go back actually many years, but the decision came in around 2015. I was exhausted from the churn of I called it feeding the beast. AJ was a commercial website, and the chase for traffic is exhausting. It is exhausting for everybody. I don't think editors, writers, or readers need that much adventure content. And I wanted something that felt like a gift to me, to all of us, where we could just slow down and really savor something and enjoy it. And it's easy to chase technology and all of the gifts that it brings us because it's so fun. It seems frictionless, and we don't think about the cost until we're really well in it. And I mean, we all know those costs, addiction to screens and, you know, blisters on our thumbs from scrolling and all that sort of stuff. And so AJ was really a response to that, in a way of reclaiming the timelessness of simple storytelling and spending time engaging with a narrative, and kind of what you do when you go into a movie theater and it's dark and you suspend your disbelief and you know you just give yourself over to that. It's very much that kind of idea, and increasingly that is a gift that we give to ourselves, where we put away the screens and we just go and we immerse ourselves in somebody else's story for a while.
Yeah. So we've been trying to book this interview with you for a while, it seems, and you had a deadline. Adventure Journal just came out. What will readers find when they open those pages? And feel free to use all the adjectives that you want.
Well, we wrapped the summer issue. We printed a couple weeks ago. This is our 33rd issue, which is kind of astounding from when I think about all the people who kind of rolled their eyes at the beginning and this. What is print again? but it's an issue that is just kind of, we don't use it as an official tagline, but I think about every issue as explore, discover, and delight. And those are really key human and universal human elements, right? Like, we are born to explore. We love to discover. And then the payoff is that joy of discovery and the delight that we find there. And that can be everything from, you know, finding a waterfall that you didn't know was there to the satisfaction of a new personal record, you know, running up a hill. I mean, it's just, there are these things that we find that we can only find for ourselves. So the summer issue has, oh my goodness, there's an amazing piece by Kevin Fedarko from his new book called A Walk in the Park, where he and photographer Pete McBride did this assignment for National Geographic. They walked the length of the Grand Canyon. And I think our tagline said, when someone asks you to go for a walk in the park, make sure you ask which park, because they got in way over their head. And then we asked some of our favorite photographers to give us their images that most perfectly captured the essence of summer. And so you have this deep dive into some really wild and gnarly and kind of smackdown experiences that Kevin and Pete had to this kind of light grazing of photography that will absolutely get you inspired for summer. So, I mean, we really think about the whole package with an issue where we have those pieces that you can sink your teeth into them. We have issue-oriented pieces. We have light, fun pieces. We really view every issue as a quarterly book, and our stories are designed to be evergreen. Nobody throws them away. Most people put them on their coffee tables. They collect them. If they don't keep them, they give them to friends or donate them to a library. And we want these, you know, one of the things that was really important to me when we launched AJ Imprint was that it was sustainable. And that word gets tossed around a lot. But one of the ways that we thought about sustainability is most magazines, especially monthly magazines, you flip through them and you toss them. And that's it. And that's just, it's heartbreaking. I mean, we work, our contributors work so hard on their art and the photography and their stories. And we wanted to build it in a way that it would honor that and also honor the reader's investment so they could pull it off the shelf in 5 years and reconnect with that piece.
I think that was a great introduction to Adventure Journal. I've been lucky enough to know Stephen for quite a while. Gosh, we go way back to early 90s, I think, is when I first met you in Jackson, actually. Let's get a little background on you just for our listeners here, and so they kind of know where you've been. I mean, did you grow up in Southern California?
No, I grew up outside Washington, D.C.
So what originally drew you to journalism? For those that don't know, Stephen was the editor of the beloved Powder magazine back in the heyday years and drove that ship. But how did you get there? I mean, was that something you saw all along?
Well, no, I mean, I couldn't have imagined something like Powder. I mean, the turn that my life took, it was hard to imagine. But, you know, I was very much formed by where I grew up. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I was born in the 60s, but I grew up in the Vietnam era. You know, I was a kid in the Vietnam era, and then I was in my teens during Watergate, and I saw the power of what an independent press like the Washington Post could do, you know, bring down a corrupt administration. And I was really inspired by that. And I actually started my quote unquote career in junior high school as a photographer. I fell in love with photography very early. And I dreamed about being a wire service photographer. I used to ditch high school and I would go down and I would shoot protests on the mall in DC and talk to the wire service photographers about their jobs. And this is a bit of a long story, but I ended up, while I was still in college, getting a job at USA Today that was supposed to be in the photo department as an assistant, and that job was filled, and I ended up as an assistant on the copy desk in the money section. And so that sort of shifted me from photography into words, and from there, I was really passionate about skiing, and I got a job as a reporter by in Burlington, Vermont, which was a newspaper owned by the same company that owned USA Today. And then from there, I ended up getting offered this job at Powder. And at Powder, I was able to bring those journalistic sensibilities. We were tiny, we had no money, so I was able to shoot when I was on stories. I could write. I was traveling with some of the world's best ski photographers, so I learned from them. So I was able to weave all of these things back together. And then at Powder, as the founding editor of Bike magazine, so I got to see what was behind a magazine launch. And then I was there for about 11 years, and our company got purchased, and everybody in management got pushed out, and I freelanced for another long time and pretty quickly found a home at National Geographic Adventure. So the threads of my career were, you know, journalism, you know, very tiny enthusiast magazine like Powder, very hardcore, where if you got something wrong, the readers really held your feet to the fire. And then, you know, a magazine on the level of National Geographic Adventure was has extremely high editorial standards, tried to be far more accessible than what Powder was trying to do. And AJ is really a synthesis of a lot of these things brought back together.
I feel like if you're 45 or older and we're subscribing to Powder and we're around those initial years of National Geographic Adventures, you really know what Stephen has brought together here with Adventure Journal. So, I mean, you have to be extremely proud of what you have created. You definitely are at the front and a leader in this kind of new movement of these super high-end publications 3-4 times a year.
Keep going. I like where you're going with
this. My question is, though, do you worry at all being out in front of that? Like, how do you view what all the new publications that are coming in? And do you almost see maybe a kind of going back to having too many titles? It's really cool that these are special titles that I think we're all now subscribing to and buying into. You know, these are our culture. We put them on the coffee table. Do you see it maybe like too many people trying to jump into the fray?
Well, the market will decide that. Yeah. And what each of us do, and some of these other publications include Mountain Gazette and Ori, and there's a really funky and cool magazine a ski magazine out of Brooklyn called Hardpack. Summit has been relaunched. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting books out there with really interesting takes. And the way that the internet has allowed us to outsource a lot of these things and have, you know, third-party vendors doing things that like Surfers Journal had to do themselves when they started in 92 enables a kind of nimbleness that wasn't there in previous generations. But at the end of all of it, the really important thing is, are you doing something that nobody else can do? Are you doing it better than anybody else could do? Are you so well-defined? And have you done that in a way that has found an audience? I mean, you can make a profitable magazine, quarterly magazine, that does 2 issues a year, that does 4 issues a year. The question is, are you able to do that over time as costs rise? You know, maybe the advertising market changes and people aren't as interested in advertising. Can you build that over time? It's kind of a subtext of your question. I think maybe it was, do I see these as competition or am I worried about them? And the answer is maybe no, because I think they're all very complementary. And even a publication that you might say is directly competitive with Adventure Journal, like Outside, I mean, what they do is so different from what we do. I mean, we're trying to be the best Adventure Journal we can. And Mike Rogge at Mountain Gazette is trying to make Mountain Gazette the best that he can. And I think you had Rogge on the show and, you know, Mountain Gazette has a very different vision from what we're doing. And our books sit side by side on people's coffee table very nicely. They're very complimentary. And, you know, we talk a lot. We connect. We little tiny micro publishers. You know, we share the slings and arrows of our fates, and we really encourage each other. So I'm excited about it, and I think the thing that is really exciting to me, especially about this New York Times piece, which if people haven't seen it, they should read it, because the writer is John Branch. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. I mean, the dude is amazing. He totally gets what we're all about. And I think that you don't have to be a super adventure lover, although most people are, to appreciate what's going on with these publications, because they're really a response to how far that we've gone with asking tech to carry our storytelling and to expect things for free, and the rise of these publications and the cost of them, because they are not cheap to make. But they are all designed with quality and longevity in mind. I mean, I think it's a reminder for people that, you know, good things cost something and good things take effort and good things are worth it.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Stephen Casimiro. He is from Adventure Journal, and he's talking to us about these high-quality magazines that people really are coming around. It's this significant movement. People are loving it. And it's not just people in our generation, our decade. I think the three of us are, you know.
yeah, we're
similarly aged. One thing, since you brought up Mike Rogge, when we were talking to him, something that really surprised me is he gave the demographic of his readership, and I can't remember the percentage, but most of them are in their 20s. And this says a lot to, you know, our digital natives saying, hey, guess what? We're sick of looking at screens. We look at them all day when we're working, and we want to lean back into the sofa with our copy of a great magazine. What are Adventure Journal's kind of demographics?
Well, they're not in their 20s. I mean, they're definitely a bit older than that. And I think one of the differences that Mountain Gazette is very kind of mountain town based, where Adventure Journal, we cover surfing, we cover canyoneering, and we cover the Southwest. We cover all kinds of things. And what is united, the connective thread of that is just this sense of openness about the world and wanting to go explore it, and through generally through outdoor recreation, whether that's bike packing or backpacking or trail running or backcountry skiing. And so our readers tend to be later in life, I mean 30s and 40s and older, and people who have a very broad-based view of adventure. And one of the challenges that we've had is that if you're a surfer, you're going to get Surfer's Journal, or you're going to go to Surfer Mag on Instagram. You're going to identify as a surfer. Very few people say, I'm an adventurer. You know, they're more like, you know, my primary interest is skiing and I also mountain bike. And so a bit of the challenge that we've had is like, well, we do a lot of these things in a really inspiring sort of way. And so it's, you know, kind of getting that word out that like the kind of narratives that we're telling, again, coming back to this idea of universal human stuff, like you can be a hardcore trail runner and still read a story about backcountry skiing in AJ, because we've worked really hard to make sure that that narrative appeals to a lot of people. So I think that our readers tend to be folks who are multi-sport faceted and who really understand the payoffs of a great tale. You know, they're readers.
Yeah. In case our listeners are interested in looking up that New York Times article, well, you can just Google Stephen Casimiro, or the title of it is In a Digital Age, High-End Outdoors Magazines Are Thriving in Print. And it was published on June 16th in the New York Times. I kind of learned about this world a long time ago. My husband grew up in Southern California, but has lived in Park City since he was 20. And if I ever want to have a few, you know, nights out with the girls, I just plan it for when he receives his copy of Surfer's Journal. I mean, and he barely notices I'm not there. It's just this complete obsession with the enjoyment. And I guess, you know, when you talk about that payoff, you know, the payoff of the enjoyment, when we talk about free publications, there's a cost, and the cost to the consumer is that you have to wade through a lot of stuff, we'll call them advertisements, things like that. Some people like that, but it's become, to me, that has become a dead model. What do you say about that?
Well, it is a dead model because advertisers have, a billion options online, and, you know, really powerful ways of reaching people online. So the traditional, I mean, this is why newspaper classified ads don't exist anymore. Craigslist, you know, I mean, it killed that model. So, you know, we have about nine advertisers. We call them ad partners because they're really investing in what we're doing. And some of them show product, but, you know, most of them are, it's really branding. It's really enhancing their brand or their connection with high quality publishing, and having a high quality space to share their brand story in AJ. So it's a different way of talking about your brand than traditional advertising. I don't understand how any of the traditional glossies are even around, and they continue to die every day, because I don't think readers want that, and advertisers don't need that. And you have to pay for things. This is the thing that is, I stress a lot to people, there is a cost to everything, and that includes the cost to you spending time on something as a reader. And so I try not to be preachy, but I also try to talk about literacy, like reading literacy, so or media literacy, and thinking about the messaging that is coming to you and what people are trying to sell you. What I'm trying to sell you is AJ. I want you to get AJ so you can read all of these amazing stories. And then our advertisers they're trying to, you know, show you that, you know, Danner makes great boots, but, you know, after that, it's up to you. I'm not trying to help Danner sell boots. I'm trying to create a really amazing magazine that will attract a certain type of people that Danner also wants to speak to. And so I just want you to read our stories. If you go to a newsstand and you look at all of those kind of desperately worded blurbs on the cover, they're begging you to pick them up. And they're also, they're preying on your insecurities. They're telling you that for you to get six-pack abs or whatever, you have to buy this magazine. And I think what AJ is about and what our cohorts are about are in this space is that we're writing to your greatest strengths and passions. And that's a really, really different way of approaching media than has traditionally been done.
Well, I think as a marketing guide, I mean, looking at your publication, if I had a high-end brand, you know, I'd be wanting to be in there aligning myself with the content you're creating. So I applaud what you're doing and how you're walking the line. It brings real value to the brands as well. So that's awesome. And along these lines, I want folks that are listening to kind of understand what it takes a little bit. I mean, I've always had kind of a foot in and paying attention to print and understand that industry. But what would you see as one of the bigger challenges to keeping, you know, this fantastic product moving forward? Because my guess would be maybe printing costs and the fluctuation and getting that out the door.
There's three challenges. One is costs. Our printing costs went up 35% during COVID. And although I feel very confident that, you know, we're giving more value than we're asking, you know, per subscription. I feel like we can't pass those costs along to the readers. So we have kept our subscription. We've raised our single copy cost to $25, but our subscription cost for a year is $60. So it's $15 and it includes free shipping. And you know, that for a lot of people, actually, that's a stretch. You know, as in the mountain culture, you know, we have people who have a ton of money. We have people who have very little money. And so we're really cognizant of wanting to make it accessible. So that's number one. The second thing is there are only so many advertisers that understand kind of your point about a premium venue and a premium readership. What I've seen is a lot of, as advertisers and brands have more tools to reach more people, that they tend to be more focused on, you know, this micromanaging of ROI instead of understanding the big picture and that need to speak to people in multiple venues. And then the last thing is just getting people to subscribe. I mean, the New York Times piece has been phenomenal. I've heard from so many people. I mean, it's incredible. But, you know, it's not like we've had a really, really nice bump in subscriptions, but it's not like thousands have come across the threshold. You know, there's so much inertia of getting somebody to actually act and commit and do that. And once we get people, I mean, we have a very low churn rate. Our renewal rate is over 90%. I've never seen it in any magazine that I've worked with. It's incredible. So we know that once we get our readers in the door, they love us and they stay with us. You know, a lot of them for a lifetime. They're like, can I buy a lifetime subscription? They will be with us forever. But actually breaking through all of those little, tiny little things that create that, you know, those barriers to somebody actually kind of completing that transaction. So, you know, those are the three things. And the first one I can't do much about, but the other two, you know, really I think comes down to relationships and marketing. And I'm not a marketer and I don't feel comfortable marketing and I don't feel comfortable spraying about how great we are. You know, I feel kind of embarrassed about all that sort of stuff. So if there's one area that we really are underperforming, we just don't market very well. And so I think that we can absolutely do a better job of conveying the benefits of AJ to people. And that's my goal over the next 6 months is like to just sort of, you know, kind of grit my teeth and, you know, and ask people more and tell them more. Try to show them especially since we're reaching people digitally, try to find a way to show them these just wonderful, God, amazing benefits of the smell of soy ink and that tactile nature of the pages on your hands. It's difficult to show through a video or through Instagram or whatever, but like it's basic human stuff that we all crave. And so I know we can do a better job with that.
Our guest is Stephen Casimiro. He is the everything at Adventure Journal, founder, editor, publisher, all of it.
And to help our listeners find you, it's adventure-journal.com. I just love on your homepage your explanation, so I'm just going to read it quickly. Adventure Journal is a printed quarterly dedicated to the thrill of exploration and the joy of motion in the great outdoors. And each issue is printed on heavyweight 70-pound uncoated body stock and 130-pound soft touch cover stock. Hey, doesn't that say it all? And it goes on about being powered by solar and sustainable paper. And, you know, what a wonderful way to introduce your potential readers to what you're doing there. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
Oh, thank you guys so much for your interest in AG. I really appreciate it and love what you do.
Yeah, great. It was a great conversation. Thanks, Stephen.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Every couple of years, a new type of diet phenomenon takes hold and grabs tons of media attention. My next guest, nutrition and diet expert and local resident, Cynthia Clark, has seen her share of these diets and the diet products that go along with it. They come and go. And she says some of these diets have lived on longer than they should. She makes no claims here about any specific diet, but she is going to present in the next half hour strategies that are applicable to virtually any diet plan. She's just published a new book on the topic. It's called Strategic Weight Loss, 20 Practical and Effective Strategies for Lifelong Success. Cindy Clark, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it is interesting. Well, I'll say this. Until I picked up your book and read it, I was thinking, wow, another diet book. But it's not a diet book. It's a strategy book. What's the difference?
Well, so one of the big differences, I think, is really understanding a huge misconception that people have is that they think if they want to lose weight, they have to make big, huge changes and clear out the refrigerator and, you know, make certain foods bad, carbs are bad, fat's bad. I mean, I've been in this arena for over 30 years now, and I've seen so many trends come and go, and it creates tons of confusion for people. And I would have clients come to me and they'd say, but I thought carbs were bad. And no. You know, there's just, it just creates so much misinformation. And really, it's all about small habits, like making little changes that you can build on and have some success with, and creating lifelong habits that really stick and make a powerful impact over the long haul.
So your degree, you have a couple of degrees, and you're an expert in diet and nutrition. You're a dietitian, a nutritionist. Talk a little bit about your practice. I've always wondered, you know, does the average person come to you to just say, I don't really know how to eat. Tell me how to eat.
Well, yes and no. Yes, they come to me to find out, you know, what can I do? They're frustrated. They're confused. But the other side of that is a lot of people would come to me with preconceived notions. So sort of like what I was talking about before, that carbs are bad, or this is bad, and this influencer says this, and the media is saying that. I think they finally come to someone like a personal trainer or a nutrition consultant because they're really frustrated and confused, and they're at a point where they're throwing their hands up in the air, like, I don't know what to do.
Yes. Well, every time I've seen a diet, a new
diet fad.
Yeah.
I just say to myself, everything in moderation. But everything in moderation is an oversimplification as well. So how do you expand on everything in moderation?
Well, first of all, I do want to say that certain diets do work for people. They can have success, but it's really not the diet itself. The magic is not in the diet. It always boils down to whatever somebody has had success with typically means that it's got them consuming fewer calories than they were before. And so it's just helpful to understand for people that you might have success with something particular that you're doing, but that's not really where the magic is. It's that it's kind of a strategy in and of itself. If you know, eating a particular way has you eating fewer calories, that's a strategy that's working for you. So, you know, what I've just found through my own personal experience, because I was overweight as a child, and I've tried everything, it really boils down to just really small changes that you build on over time.
You do tell a pretty compelling story in the introduction of your book, Strategic Weight Loss, and it's about the bullying and the shaming that went on for you as a child. I'm looking at you across the table from me now, and you're very thin, but you weren't as a child. Can you talk about that whole journey? Because I know a lot of parents probably don't know what to do and how to help their children who are maybe overweight.
Well, I'll be straight. Like, it was awful. Like, so I'm one of four girls in my family. Two of my sisters were naturally very thin, and me and one of my other sisters had a weight problem. And we were all eating the same thing, and I couldn't understand it. The sister that's closest to me in age ate Doritos and Twinkies, and this was back when there was no internet, you know, and there was no information available. And so it was pretty much Weight Watchers and Dexatrim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy to think about Dexatrim because it's, you know, it's no longer available, but
I had forgotten about that.
I know, but that's pretty much all we had, and nothing against Weight Watchers. But that was all there was. And so, you know, my mom didn't know what to do. I mean, she was completely baffled also. You know, she had two kids that were overweight, two that were thin. And I remember going to these Weight Watchers meetings. And back then, I don't know what they do now, but they'd put you on a scale. There would be like a lineup at the end of the meeting, and you'd get on a scale, and they'd kind of call out your weight. And then they'd call out, no pounds lost or half a pound lost. It was really awful.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they don't do that now, but I just was trying anything and everything, and most of it didn't work. And then, you know, the bullying was horrible. It was a really rough journey. So everything in my book has been through trial and error. And just finding out, okay, this is what works. And even the things I want to say that, you know, were quote unquote failures for me, I was able to glean knowledge from every single experience. Okay, this is something that is healthy and works versus, okay, that is junk, that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting as well. You probably grew up in the time like I did. I kind of remember it was around high school, college age, where there was, you know, all fats are bad, and there was all this fake food.
Yes.
That was low fat or no fat, and we're eating these extremely processed foods that had removed the fat. So
yes, I actually am thinking of one food in particular that we bought in my household because we thought, okay, this is healthier because it was so anti-fat back then, and it was Entenmann's. Do you remember that brand, Entenmann's?
No.
It was a delicious pastry brand. And they all of a sudden came out with a fat-free Entenmann's, which is it makes me laugh now because it was just super processed, loaded with sugar, just nothing, no redeemable factors to it at all. But we thought, oh, okay, this is a better choice because it's fat-free. Because back then, the fat-free thing was huge, and everybody, all the product lines were cutting out their fat. But they were super processed still and loaded with sugar to compensate for the lack of fat.
flavor that
so flat-free. So not a good thing.
Right. I'm curious, at what point and how did you turn that corner with your own weight to the point you are now? I mean, and is it, because it seems to be sort of a genetic thing in your family with two genetically thin and two genetically overweight.
Yeah.
You know, how has that played out throughout your life?
Well, what I first came upon, you know, through just trying and failing, there was a summer where I turned the corner where all of a sudden, you know, it seems really obvious now, but again, back then, I really was just, you know, throwing things up against the wall and seeing what stuck. I just decided, okay, there's a local health club. I'm going to ride my bike there. I'm going to take an aerobics class. That was when aerobics classes were all the rage. And then I'll ride my bike home. And I started seeing my weight go down, and I thought, oh, okay, this is actually working. So I'm going to keep doing this. Okay, exercise, good. Yeah. That's just how naive I was. And to answer your other question, it's something that I would say I pay attention to, because I definitely do think, you know, I'm not one of those people that just has ever been able to eat whatever I want. But it's more that the habits have just become a part of my life, and I don't, it's not effort as much. Like, I just look at it like brushing my teeth, getting up and exercising. It's the same as brushing my teeth every day. The way that I eat and kind of view things is just now more ingrained. And but I will say that the focus has changed over the years from, of course, when I was younger, I wanted to be smaller, so I looked like my friends and wasn't teased. But now the focus is strength, health, longevity, those types of things. So my focus has just changed, but all of those habits have just been ingrained.
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with local resident and author Cynthia Clark. Her book is called Strategic Weight Loss, 20 Practical and Effective Strategies for Lifelong Success. I like, Cindy, how in the book, you know, again, this is about strategy. It's not about diet. So strategy, and this is something that I often am under the illusion that I can control when, so it has to do with, you say, you know that you're only good for exercising in the morning. If you put it off, you won't do it.
Exactly.
So that's one of your strategies, is to always exercise in the morning and organize your schedule around that. So I am the person that says, on those days I don't really want to exercise, I say to myself, okay, I'm going to go in the afternoon. And how often do you actually do that is a whole other question.
Yeah.
So it's really about knowing yourself and not lying to yourself.
100%, because I've met people that are completely fine with going through a full work day and they love going to the gym after work, and that works fine for them, and that's great, but I have just learned that that does not work for me. And the other thing that I've learned is, as much as I love the idea of working out at home, and a lot of people do great with that, If I leave myself to my own devices and think, oh, I'll do a workout at home, it's not going to happen. Maybe once in a while, but I just know that that is not a strategy that works for me. I need to get to the gym, or better yet, I like to tell a lot of people that really don't exercise but they want to get into the habit, I like to advise people, pick a class. Start out with a class, especially the ones now, it seems like most places that offer classes. They have an app. You have to sign up for a particular class in advance. It gets on your schedule. And if you don't show up, you get a financial penalty.
Yes,
and helps. So, yeah, it really holds you accountable to yourself to making it to that class. And so that's a great strategy to start with. Some people will continue with that for good because they just figure out, okay, this is what works for me. Or they just really love a class and they know that they have to schedule it in advance and get on the app. But I just think that's a great way to start if you're struggling with getting yourself into the habit of exercising every day or hiring a personal trainer because you're paying somebody, you've got a time you've got to show up by. So that's another strategy. And they're teaching you proper form, which is a bonus.
Yes, yes. Now you have this other strategy it's kind of like a it's a strategy, but it's for those people who do not love to exercise.
Yeah.
And it's the acronym is NEAT.
Yes. Well, so it's not only NEAT. What NEAT is non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So it can be used for people that don't like structured exercise, but really what NEAT is about is it's all the activity outside of your structured workout. Mm-hmm. So, and this might, you know, upset some people because I think, you know, everybody likes to feel like, okay, I did my hard workout in the morning. I'm good now. I can relax for the day. But really, that non-exercise activity thermogenesis is all the movement you do outside of a structured workout. And you could kind of substitute structured workout with NEAT also. But mostly what it's about is not sitting on the couch. So after you've had your workout, don't take it like, okay, now I'm good for the day, I can slack off. It's any kind of movement. It's cleaning your house. It's if you've got a desk job, getting a stand-up desk, standing as much as you can, getting up and taking breaks and moving around. It's going to the grocery store. All the movement outside of the structured workout. It's really, really valuable. And sometimes that's the missing piece because people will come to me and they'll say, I'm working out really hard and I feel like I'm eating well and I'm eating healthy, but something's not right. And oftentimes it's because they're really sedentary for the rest of the day.
Right.
So that's one of those missing elements that people often don't think of if they're, you know, unless you're doing heavy duty endurance training, if you're just doing kind of like a 1 hour workout in the morning and then being really sedentary, sometimes that's the missing piece. And I love pedometers. I wear a pedometer because it's a way to keep track of your NEAT, your non-exercise activity thermogenesis. You can look down and if you're like, gosh, I only have 1500 steps for the day, that's an indication to get me up and say, okay, I need to get up and move. I need to do something.
Those steps apps seem to be invaluable. I mean, I know people who weren't really exercisers, but then they are so committed to doing their 10,000 or 15,000 or 20,000 steps a day. And what about the pace too? Like, is there something about when I walk, I try to, you know, if I park in an outlying area and I'm going to the grocery store, which I always try to do, because guess what? You don't get car doors opened into your car.
That's an extra benefit.
I know. That's what I always tell myself when I'm feeling, you know, lazy. Well, no one's going to open their car door if I park way out there. And then I try to walk fast. You know, is there something about the picking up the pace and really moving and kind of creating that extra burn?
Absolutely. I mean, anytime you can add a little extra exertion, it's good for your body, it's good for your heart, you know, it's just good for everything. But I'll say that even if you're just doing leisurely walks, there's still a lot of value to that. You know, any kind of movement, there's value to. It's the sitting down all day that's really not great for us.
Yes. Sitting is the new smoking.
I know. It's true, though.
Yeah. It's true. And
nothing is quite as bad as smoking.
Yeah,
let's
exactly.
be clear. But yeah.
Exactly. So your book is in parts. You haven't, the part one is the introduction. And then part two about nourishment strategies, part three, movement, rest, progress strategies, and then part four, mindset strategies. And then you have a bunch of appendixes, I guess that's a plural for appendix. And these are sample grocery lists and emergency food ideas. So much of it is keeping the good food in your house and not the bad food. Boy, if I've got arugula there all the time and no ice cream, guess what I'm going to eat?
Exactly. And that's one of the huge keys. And it's often overlooked. If you've got your refrigerator and your pantry stocked with the good choices, it makes it so much easier. And then you mentioned the preparation. That's a strategy that I still use every single day. I have meat sticks in my purse right now. Or almonds. I've got a little Ziploc baggie of almonds, because if you're prepared, then when you get stuck in traffic and maybe it's been 6 hours since you ate because you've been in meetings and now you're stuck in a traffic jam, I've got something in my purse or in a cooler, especially right now it's really hot out. I keep a little cooler in my car. And I stock it with things like protein bars and stuff like that, bottled water, so that I've always got something available. Because what happens if it's not there is that, my car starts to veer towards some place that sells something that I really shouldn't eat because I'm really hungry. And when you're hungry, you're vulnerable. And that's when you're most likely to go off the deep end and walk into the corner store and get something really, really bad. And then you feel bad about your choice. And then you're full and you don't have the dinner that you plan to have. And so, yeah, preparation is everything.
Yeah. Why is it that when we get really hungry, we don't necessarily crave the thing that's really good for us?
I
mean, I'm guilty of that too. If I'm hungry, I do. I go to the place that is going to serve something, and I know it's not good for me, but I say, I just need something to tide me over.
Yes.
But it's always something bad for you.
I know. Well, it's because our blood sugar drops. And once our blood sugar drops, it's sort of like, look out, you've got to, hold me back from the food. And so much about the preparation is, or being prepared and living prepared, is preventing those huge blood sugar drops from happening in the first place. Making sure you have snacks available, making sure that you always have really good choices stocked in your refrigerator. If you've got kids and they've got certain foods that they really love, and maybe they're not something that's on your plan, as long as you've got your choices, front and center, then it's going to make you more likely to make the good choice than the bad choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so moving on to, there are very few things that you actually say you must do this, but one of those is don't eat 2 hours before bedtime.
Yes, and so it is a little bit of an arbitrary time limit, right? So I'm not, I say 2 hours because I've found that it's just enough time that helps you fully digest so that when you go to sleep, you're not up all night, having to go to the bathroom. Your digestion is kind of complete so that you're settled, you have better sleep. But it's not so long of a period of time that you're going to be hungry again for another meal right when you're about to go to bed, because you don't want to go to bed starving. But if you can put kind of a boundary on your eating, like a hard and fast boundary, what it does is it stops you or prevents you from mindless snacking.
Yes.
And that is a real, it's one of those things that seems really innocent when you're doing it. But adding it up over time, if you're doing that mindless snacking, like opening up a bag of popcorn and just kind of eating while you're watching TV, it really can sabotage you. And so having that two-hour boundary is incredibly helpful. And I would say if that's all someone can manage to start as their first strategy, I think people would be really surprised at not only how it improves their sleep, but also how they start to see changes.
Mm. A bit ago, we were talking about processed food, and you have a chapter in here. It's one of the strategies on estrogens and obesogens.
Yes.
I've never heard that word before. Is that your own word?
No, it's actually kind of out there in the data.
Okay.
That's emerging. And it's, they're hormone disruptors. Basically, there's emerging data that suggests that a lot of the chemical additives, pesticides, that they're actually hormone disruptors, which is a little disconcerting, you know, that, and we're exposed to them whether we want to be or not. I mean, they're everywhere, but I like to encourage people, if you can remove as many obvious chemicals from your life as you can, it may be something that's helpful. It's not so much something that you're gonna see, you know, like maybe in your pant size, that, you know, like, I can't say that that's something measurable, but there is emerging data to suggest that it may be a contributing factor to some of the struggles people are having with unwanted weight.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have just a few minutes left, but this book just strikes me as it's like a common sense approach.
Yes.
And it's, most of these things in here are probably things that a lot of us who are in tune with health and nutrition already know, but
yes,
it's a really good reminder. You do have a whole chapter on eliminating alcohol.
Yes, yes.
Very important, and, you know, this, it's so enmeshed in society and culture.
Yeah, it's, okay, so it's one of those topics that when I would approach it with a client, it kind of sparks some irritation and resistance. And I understand why, because, you know, it is so, alcohol is very intertwined with our social lives and our social activities. But it can have a huge impact. I mean, just eliminating alcohol, I suggest to people, if you really struggle with the idea, try it for 1 month, see how you feel. People come back and they report better sleep. I mean, obviously weight loss. Some people, they're drinking so regularly that they don't even understand how many extra calories it's adding to their day.
Yes. Well, the book is Strategic Weight Loss. It's 20 practical and effective strategies for lifelong success. My guest is Cindy Clark, or Cynthia Clark,
either
Clark
way,
with an E.
Yes.
And your website again.
Yes, strategicweightlossbook.com. And you can also find my book on Amazon.
Excellent. Cindy, congratulations and thanks for a great little, really easy to read book.
Thank you so much for having me on. If I can help one person, I would be so excited.
Great. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.